If you're looking for reason and logic in the process, you're probably going to be disappointed.
The role lobbyists play in shaping the capital budget in Juneau. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, insurance companies wait for the federal government to release details on the health insurance exchange it's building for Alaska.
We're still waiting on what's going to happen there, so we're quite frankly on pins and needles because we want to be able to do this well.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
The Senate confirmed President Barack Obama's nominee to lead the Interior Department, Sally Jewell, this evening. 87 senators voted to confirm the former chief executive of REI, including both Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich. Before the vote, Senator Murkowski took to the Senate floor to praise Jewell's work in the private sector, from her time at REI to her work in the oil fields of Oklahoma. The 11 no votes were all Republican. The U.S. Senate will vote tomorrow on whether to begin debate on a package of new gun regulations. The bill aims to strengthen school safety and stiffen penalties for gun trafficking. There could be amendments to establish an assault weapons ban and limit the size of magazines. And as APRN's Peter Granitz reports, there will be one amendment that would require background checks for guns bought and sold online and at gun shows, an amendment that neither of Alaska's senators has committed to.
Pennsylvania Republican Pat Toomey is no moderate. Before the Senate, he was president of the Club for Growth, a group that supports Tea Party candidates in primary campaigns against insufficiently conservative incumbents. So gun control advocates are excited he's a co-sponsor of an amendment that would close the so-called gun show loophole. Introducing his amendment, he put it bluntly.
I don't consider criminal background checks to be gun control. I think it's just common sense.
When he was speaking, the NRA issued a press release saying expanded background checks will not prevent the next school shooting or stop violent crime. One of Senator Toomey's co-sponsors is West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin. Both he and Senator Toomey have A ratings from the NRA. When Senator Manchin first ran for the Senate, he was criticized for a campaign commercial where he fired a shot through a climate change bill. But Senator Manchin says the Newtown shootings changed the debate, that the country needs to strengthen the background check system.
If you go to a gun show, that's tight. You have to do all background checks and have to be recorded with an FFL, a federal firearms licensed dealer. The same as you do if you go to the gun store, who that would be a licensed dealer. If you go online, the same.
Senator Lisa Murkowski discussed the amendment with Senator Toomey. She says she has concerns on how the new background checks would be implemented in rural Alaska.
If an individual wants to buy a gun over the internet, from what I understand, the only way that they would be able to do that is if they went to a town where there is a federally, where there is a licensed gun dealer, so that that dealer could then do the check.
The amendment does not require background checks for private sales. If a person in a remote village wants to sell a gun to a neighbor or family member, they could still do so. And it explicitly outlaws any national registry of firearm sales. The vote on Thursday is not on passage of the amendment or the bill. It's just to begin debate. And at least 13 Republicans say they will filibuster the motion. Senator Murkowski is noncommittal on whether she'll join the filibuster. Senator Mark Begich, who faces re-election next year, says he has problems with the overall package, especially a provision from New York Democratic Senator Charles Schumer that would monitor every gun sold in America. Senator Begich would not say whether he plans to join the filibuster. He says he won't decide until he knows whether the Senate will vote on his amendment that he says would strengthen mental health reporting.
I'm still patiently waiting to hear what they're going to tell me on my bill.
Both Senators Begich and Murkowski don't have much time to make up their minds. A vote is scheduled for 11 o'clock Thursday morning. Senator Harry Reid thinks he has the requisite 60 votes needed to overcome the blockade. He'll need yes votes from Republicans, especially if he cannot get all the moderate Democrats.
I don't get all the Democrats all the time, and that's for sure.
One thing is certain. Any vulnerable senator who votes yes to debate the gun package will not necessarily vote yes on its passage. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
ConocoPhillips announced today it is suspending its Chukchi seed drilling campaign. The company says regulatory uncertainty led to the decision. Natalie Lohman is a spokeswoman for ConocoPhillips in Alaska. She says the federal government has instituted new regulations on Arctic drilling since the company first bought the rights to drill in the Arctic Ocean.
The requirement to specifically identify both a primary rig and a relief rig and require that contracts be executed for both of those assets. And that's all prior to even deeming our exploration plan be complete. Another requirement that's new is to specifically identify all vessels, equipment, and oil spill responders.
Last month, the Department of Interior released an assessment of Shell Oil's bungled Arctic drilling campaign. That report says Shell's subcontractors operated without oversight from the company. Before Shell can drill again, it needs to prove to the government it can manage its subcontractors. Lohman says ConocoPhillips' decision is not based solely on new regulations resulting from Shell's botched drilling season. Lois Epstein with the Wilderness Society is applauding the company's decision.
Shell had a number of problems. The federal government is working out the kinks and putting in place needed regulations and policies that ensure that everybody's doing a good job. So it makes sense for ConocoPhillips not to go forward and for everyone to get their ducks in line beforehand.
Epstein says no one wants a Gulf of Mexico-sized oil spill in the Arctic Ocean. Senator Murkowski sent out an email response to the company's decision, blaming the federal government for creating an unacceptable level of uncertainty on the rules for offshore Arctic drilling. Alaska's federally run health insurance exchange is supposed to be ready to enroll participants on October 1st. But with that deadline less than 6 months away, insurance companies and the state's Division of Insurance say they have little information on what the online insurance marketplace will look like. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Alaska's insurance director, Brett Kolb, heard from a husband and wife last week. They wanted some basic information on the federal health insurance exchange.
What is it going to look like? How does this play out? And unfortunately, we don't know what a federally facilitated exchange is going to look like.
Alaska and 25 other states decided not to develop insurance exchanges, which are required under the Affordable Care Act. When Governor Sean Parnell made that decision, he gave up millions of dollars in grants to establish the exchange and left the work to the federal government. The exchanges are online marketplaces that will allow consumers to shop for health care policies and determine if they qualify for subsidies to help pay for them. That may sound pretty simple, but there are a lot of complicated questions to work out. Questions Kolb says the federal government hasn't been able to answer.
The answers that we will get are soon. We'll get you an answer to that. We'll get you guidance. We understand what the date is. We know the timeline, but we don't have an answer yet, is what we're getting from the federal government.
The questions the state wants answers to are pretty simple. What will the exchange website look like? How much will consumers pay to use it? And when is the government going to start an advertising campaign to let people know about it? Insurers in the state have their own questions, including how they will connect electronically with the exchange. Jason Godey is with ODS, the fourth largest insurer in Alaska. The company also offers health insurance in Oregon and Washington, where officials are establishing state-run exchanges. And he says the difference between those states and Alaska is stark.
It's interesting. We have weekly exchange implementation meetings, and I sit in on all of those, and there's always a big flurry of activity for Oregon and Washington, and when Alaska comes up, it's basically, you know, we're still waiting on what's going to happen there, so we're quite frankly on pins and needles because we want to be able to do this well.
The state's largest health insurer, Primera, is also eager for information about the federal exchange. Jeff Davis is president of Primera. He had hoped Alaska would set up its own exchange so the state could design it to fit the needs of Alaskans. He says the company is committed to participating in the federal exchange, but Davis says so far the federal government has provided very little information.
We have tried, and many, many, many others have tried, and the answers range from, we'll get back to you on that soon, we'll have that for you, the first of spring, those sorts of answers are what we're getting. It's simply not available, and I anticipate that means it's not been worked out yet.
The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services declined to make someone available to interview for this story. A spokesperson says development of the exchange, or marketplace, is underway, and that we are deeply committed to public participation in the building of the new marketplaces. Stan Dorn is not surprised the federal government has been slow to provide information. He's a health policy expert with a nonpartisan Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. He says the politics surrounding the controversial health care law have hampered the process.
Federal officials are very cautious, and understandably so. They don't want to make the slightest misstep, so they need to think very carefully, long and hard, before they release any plans for what they want to do. It's really a shame. It really takes what are usually slow processes and makes them even slower.
Dorn expects the federal exchange to be up and running in Alaska on time, but he says it won't have all the bells and whistles that will be available in states that are establishing their own exchanges.
They'll be able to get the basic job done in year one, no question about that. But a lot of the more exciting features of the exchange won't be available until later years.
One of those features that won't be ready in time would let small companies give their employees a choice between several plan options when they use the exchange. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an unsuccessful attempt to move an eagle's nest in Unalaska.
We tried to fool Mother Nature and she didn't get fooled.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
The Alaska State Legislature is putting the finishing touches on a $2 billion capital budget. Even though it's small in comparison to previous years, it still funds hundreds of projects, big and small, across the state. But how do lawmakers decide which ones take priority? APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez takes a look at how one set of players figure into that process, lobbyists.
Lobbyists are well aware of their reputation. It's not the sort of job that six-year-olds say they want to be when they grow up. From the looks of it, it involves a lot of ducking in and out of legislators' offices and lingering on benches outside of committee rooms. One of their own describes them as seagulls, ready to feast on a stream full of rotting salmon carcasses. But if you have a project you want funded, you might want to turn to one. Ray Gillespie has been lobbying for 25 years, and he helps cities like Kodiak and Unalaska navigate the politics behind the capital budget.
Yeah, hiring a lobbyist smooths out the process. It also, I think, increases the chances that you'll get funded, because a lobbyist presumably understands the process, understands when to who to talk to, who not to talk to, who's in a majority organization, who isn't, who's on finance, who isn't. And most municipal employees and a lot of municipally elected officials don't understand the basic fundamentals of how the process works.
Nearly 40 cities and boroughs hired lobbyists for this legislative session. Combined, they spent well over $1 million to make sure that legislators heard about their priorities. According to state filings, the Northwest Arctic Borough spent the most, putting $110,000 toward a salaried government affairs staffer. It seems to be paying off. When the Senate picked over the governor's proposed budget, basically a first draft of the document, they didn't take out items. They added them. There was money for the borough's magnet school, ultrasound equipment, and an upgrade of their fuel dispenser. All told, their district got $45 million. Meanwhile, Unalaska spent about $80,000 on Gillespie's services. Mayor Shirley Marquardt says they haven't gotten everything they want, but they've managed to protect $6 million in funding for water treatment plants. She's pleased with the arrangement.
Communities all over the state think it's a worthwhile, you know, expenditure to have someone. I mean, if you can afford it and if you're lucky enough to get somebody who really understands the process.
Marquardt says that by having someone in Juneau, the city saves a lot of staff time and travel money. Their lobbyists can schedule a meeting with a senator's office without having to board two flights. As co-chair of the Senate Finance Committee, Anchorage Republican Kevin Meyer plays a major role in crafting the capital budget. He says that there are a lot of factors that come into play. They have to look at what the governor wants. They talk to all the other lawmakers to see what they want. They factor in how much districts have traditionally gotten. They also collect project request forms from communities and organizations across the state. This year, they got nearly $4 billion worth of asks and whittled that down to $2 billion in funded projects. Meyer downplays the influence that lobbyists have, but says they do have their place.
I look at them as a hired gun. I mean, they're representing their client, maybe not necessarily what's best for the whole state, but what's best for their client.
Gillespie gets that a lot.
Yeah, of course. we're salesmen, but most lobbyists have some experience and background in government or in the legislature.
And he says in a state with so many small communities and such a small tax base, state funding can play a big role in a city's budget.
Their goals and objectives reflect that they're political subdivisions of the state. They have limited ways of raising money. In some cases, they have very little taxable property and very little in terms of local revenues.
Gillespie says that the most successful municipalities are the ones who can argue how their project is good for the state at large. But even if you've got a project that helps more than just your community or that has a long-term benefit in terms of safety or education or even future revenue, it still might not get funded. There isn't a limitless supply of money, and there's plenty of competition for that pool. And then politics enters the process. Gillespie understands that can be confusing to most people.
If you're looking for reason and logic in the process, you're probably going to be disappointed. It comes together, and it's a mystery to me sometimes how it happens, and I've been doing it for, you know, almost 30 years. So it's not an exact science. But for the layperson, you know, the average Alaskan, the process probably makes no sense at all. And I totally understand that. I get that.
And that confusion is exactly what keeps Gillespie and the dozens of other lobbyists around the Capitol in business. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The Alaska Senate is scheduled to vote soon on a controversial piece of legislation that's part of Governor Parnell's effort to streamline the permitting process for developments on state land. KDLG's Mike Mason has the details.
On Monday, the Finance Committee in the Alaska Senate referred House Bill 77 out of committee, but not without some concerns being raised by a couple of members of the committee. Last week, the Finance Committee took a couple of days' worth of public testimony on House Bill 77. The vast majority of the testimony was in opposition to the bill, and many of those in opposition cited the bill's language to amend the water reservation statutes in Alaska to exclude non-government entities from making a reservation. That means that individuals, native tribes, and corporations would not be able to apply for a water reservation to keep water in a stream or river. However, state and federal agencies, as well as municipalities, would be able to make such an application. Currently, Alaska is the only state in the nation that allows non-government entities to apply for a water reservation. The language calling for the elimination of non-government entities from the water reservation system is opposed by District S State Senator Lyman Hoffman from Bethel, but he didn't object to the bill being referred out of the Senate Finance Committee.
I believe that there are many good provisions in this bill, but there still remains a grave concern of the testimony that came before this body regarding now Section 42. And I do believe that it is a mistake to exclude a person in this section, but I will not oppose the bill moving and will sign the report amend.
A committee substitute for House Bill 77 was rolled out Monday morning. It included some new language. For instance, the new version of the bill includes language stipulating that performance of a feasibility study for the Chicoutimi Lake Hydroelectric Project is not an incompatible use for the Wood-Tikchik State Park. The language was inserted at the request of Senator Liesl McGuire. She had sponsored Senate Bill 32 that would allow a feasibility study for the Chicoutimi Lake Hydro Project. That bill's been stalled in committee, and its language has been rolled into House Bill 77. During Monday's meeting, Finance Committee Co-Chair Kevin Meyer explained the reasoning for adding the feasibility study authorization to House Bill 77.
Money was obtained last year in the capital budget for a hydro project in that area, but they do need access to the park in order to do the feasibility study for the hydro project. So we've already funded partially funded the study, and now they just need access to the park.
The Wood-Tikchik State Park is located in the Bristol Bay region, and it's the largest state park in the U.S. Nuvista Light and Electric Cooperative is looking at the feasibility of developing a large hydroelectric project in the park. However, the Chicoutimi Lake Hydro Project is not grandfathered into the park's charter, and many users believe a project like Chicoutimi is incompatible with the mission of the state park. The proposed changes to the bill, plus the controversial concepts in the original bill, sparked opposition during Monday's committee hearing from Senator Donnie Olson.
As you look at the whole situation, you've made a controversial bill even more controversial, a bill that has had 95% of the people testifying on it against it. You complicated by another bill that's combined in there, and I think that the judgment of the chairman is somewhat clouded by the press and the pressure that is on him, because we're trying to get to the end of the session. But I would say, if that's the case, then hold the thing over and do like I suggested, is have a subcommittee look at it later on, or else hold it up for a special session when we come to it. Don't start putting legislation through that's controversial to start off with and make it even more complicated by adding another bill to it.
Senator Olson is recommending that his fellow senators not pass House Bill 77. The vote on the bill is currently scheduled for Wednesday. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at KinnickArmBridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Every spring on Alaska prepares to do battle with the national bird. Eagles become territorial when they nest, and that sometimes leads to attacks on unsuspecting pedestrians. This year, the city tried to preempt the bird blitz by destroying the nest of a particularly combative pair. But as KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports, the eagles weren't so easily thwarted.
Clinic Director Eileen Scott was among the first to notice that the eagles had rebuilt. Her office faces the cliff, and she watched as the pair carried stick after stick to their new perch.
So it is right there above where the silver light post is. It's about 5 feet above that, and it's actually 20 feet lower than what it was last year.
20 feet closer to the sidewalk and to passers-by. The eagle's original nest was removed because the pair had sent at least half a dozen people to the clinic over the last few years. And Scott says they took the removal personally.
They have an axe to grind because we took away their house or what, but they're not happy this year.
Not eager to tangle with eagle talons, Scott has become hypervigilant.
Well, usually I see one of them right above the clinic building, so I have make sure I have my key to get into the building and my briefcase and everything. So I walk very, very fast to the door to hurry up and put the key in to unlock the door to get in, just as a precaution.
Scott isn't the only one who takes care when in the vicinity of the clinic. Ben Bolock regularly passes the pair while running.
Even today, I ran up past there, and I had my dog with me, and I went the wide way through the clinic parking lot and put my hood up and gazed back a few times, and people were probably wondering, why is that guy running through the parking lot when he could be going on the sidewalk just to get a little bit better view and to see him coming a little bit quicker.
Bolock has good reason to be afraid. A few years ago, he was out running at night, and an eagle swooped at him from behind, puncturing his scalp.
I was only on the island for 2 months, so I wasn't really aware that eagles attack just yet.
Since then, Bolock's been swooped at least a half dozen times, and he's also seen others get attacked. Bolock is from Ohio, and he says 3 years ago, the idea of destroying an eagle's nest would have shocked him. But he wasn't upset when the city hired Advanced Blasting to get rid of the clinic nest in January.
I was so excited that they had the nest fixed by the clinic. And then, you know, it's like I almost stopped in my tracks once I saw two birds perched right next to it. I'm like, no, no, it's like a bad dream.
$15,000 worth of hydraulics work and wire mesh didn't stop the eagles from rebuilding. As city manager Chris Laddick put it,
we tried to fool Mother Nature and she didn't get fooled.
Since the engineered solution failed, the city decided to go a little more low-tech. On Friday night, the fire department took a hose to the cliff and knocked down the accumulation of sticks with the federal government's blessing. But there's no guarantee the eagles won't come back. That's why there's still a spray-painted sign warning, danger, nesting eagles at the bottom of the cliff. Just in case. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
A Gwich'in Athabascan version of Shakespeare's King Lear is going on statewide tour, KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Lear Hey Quay is set in the 1800s, just after Alaska Natives' first contact with Westerners. Fairbanks Shakespeare Theater Managing Director Rebecca Eddy says the production blends the traditional King Lear story with the Alaska Native experience.
A lot about changes and facing a new world, and he's trying to hold on to his way of life, and the way he does it is by dividing his kingdom and to try and adapt, you know, to the new ways. And we parallel that with the way that, you know, Alaska Native cultures are trying to hold on to their ways, but also pass them on in this new, ever-changing world.
Lear Hey Quay was written by Gwich'in speaker and teacher Alan Hayton. The play cast includes several Native actors, and half of the dialogue is spoken in Gwich'in Athabascan. Lear Hey Quay premiered in Fairbanks over the weekend and is moving on to performances around the state, a mix of public and school shows from Homer to Kotzebue. The project is partially funded by a National Endowment for the Arts, Shakespeare and American Communities program. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Mike Mason in Dillingham, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Do you own a business or manage employees? Research shows that employees who feel supported at work with their parenting challenges are more loyal and productive. When you let employees know they can attend a teacher conference, stay at home with a sick child, or adjust their schedule to secure quality child care, you contribute to stronger families. That's Strengthening Families Alaska Style. This message is sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust, THREAD, and Best Beginnings. Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.